Hi guys, and welcome to another edition of Talking Finance with Dan. I've got my old boss with me, James Angus. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm really excited about this, not only to sort of discuss the things we're about to discuss today, but just more generally work a little more closely with you again and share some things about me and Bluestone.
Excellent. Let's introduce you to the rest of the audience in terms of who James Angus is and so forth, because this is going to be part of the, this particular podcast anyway, is going to be part of the Humans of Finance series. So let's start from the very beginning. How did you find yourself into, you know, falling into finance?
Yeah, good question. I think I was a lot like going through, you know, high school and university in the late 80s, early 90s. I studied finance and economics at university. Something that a lot of people know about me and a lot don't know is I actually had a long, you know, professional rugby union career. What was great about working in finance, and in those days, sort of mid-90s, I was working for Suncorp, is that they gave me a lot of flexibility to, you know, for my rugby career, and I was, you know, traveling a lot and training a lot. So I was based out of an old Suncorp branch in up the top of, you know, Pitt Street Mall back in the the mid-90s, and it was a great introduction for me, you know, into finance. You're sort of a bit of a jack of all, you know, all trade. It wasn't a trading retail branch but we did a lot of the home loan lending and other lending out of there.
So you kind of had the best of the young 20 year old's life of working in the banks and playing rugby at the same time
and traveling the world, you could say that. So that was my introduction, and I really enjoyed it. I mean, I've always been very sort of strong around sort of numbers and on the analytical side, and I just loved, you know, working with numbers, and it was all a bit of a puzzle / problem solving for me, so I really enjoyed it.
Oh, there you go. Okay, well, so basically I did not know that aspect. I knew about you with your association with Macquarie Bank, obviously when I joined it, but you joined Macquarie Bank in 2001, I believe, is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yep. 2001.
Yeah. So the landscape pre GFC is a lot different to what it is post GFC.
Yeah, it is. And there's actually just a bit of a funny story about joining Macquarie. Is, you know, you may not recall this, but when Macquarie made the decision sort of 99, 2000 to really make a push, you know, into the broker channel, they actually hired almost the entire team, the broker team, out of Suncorp.
Oh, nice.
So Doug Lee and his, you know, merry band of gentlemen, who are still, you know, in the industry in various forms. Others are long gone. And one of the guys I worked with, you know, directly, was a guy called Mark Muggeridge, who, you know, came across to, you know, to Macquarie, I think about, can't remember what year it was, to 2000. And he sort of facilitated an introduction, you know, for me. I knew of Doug, didn't know him personally then. Facilitated an introduction, and Doug said, yeah, you should come with us. So, you know, I think in that sort of span of 6 months or so, I think there was about, including me, about eight people that moved from Suncorp to Macquarie. I mean, Laurie Duffus was one that many people know. Laurie from...
I did not know.
His A&P days. Gerald Ventrice, you know, was another one. It's a funny story. But, to answer your question, I digress. Yeah, look, very, very different today versus, you know, what the landscape was like when I joined Macquarie in 2001. And a couple of things jumped to mind. And I was sort of writing a few notes for myself as I was preparing for this. And as I reflect back on those early days, a few things that people may not remember or may not even know. APRA had only been in existence for, I think, 3 years at that point. So this is pre-NCCP days, really pre-APRA days. So you can imagine the oversight regime was very, very light, you know, in those days. And I think even the MFAA, in terms of things like disciplinary rules, members, you know, the education standards, you know, at least holding a certificate for that, they all came in years after 2001. So we didn't even, you know, have that as it relates to, you know, a bit of rigor or a bit of framework around the way that we work with brokers. Broker market share, I think when I joined in 2001, was around 15% or maybe 20%. It was the aggregation landscape was very simple. No Connective. I mean, I think from memory in those days, we had AFG, of course, Mortgage Choice, Choice Plan. I think NMB had just started. It was very, very simple from an aggregation landscape perspective. CBA didn't really have the stronghold they have today. They'd only just entered the broker channel via their acquisition of Colonial. And there was no brokers at Aussie. Aussie was still, you know, their branded, you know, business, and there was no online lodgements, no HEM, no living expenses. So it was very, very different.
Yeah, well, I joined the third party side around about 2006, but not working with you. But, you know, I was at Citibank at the time when I was an assessor. Yeah. And obviously before the GFC, you know, self-employed, low-doc, you could do if you can recall, a loan where you didn't actually need to put a figure on, just the customer just needs to say they can afford the loan. So,
I mean, I think it's a very good point, and I wrote down sort of Lodoc's a great example of that. I think the market pre-GFC got to about 10% or more of Lodoc, but you might remember, actually it was before you joined, I think we were as high as at Macquarie, 40%, you know, Lodoc, just before the GFC. So, you know, certainly the landscape, you know, was very different, both from a technology standpoint, I think from an aggregation standpoint, very different. And then certainly if we think about, you know, our industry today, from a regulatory landscape perspective, it was very different as well.
And there you go. Well, before we actually had this conversation anyway, I stalked your profile a bit more. I actually thought you never had a gap. I thought you just went to, you know, the big donut and you stayed there until recently. But you took a bit of a gap over to the US.
Yeah, I did actually. I was always wanting to move to the US. I mean, my wife's American from Northern Virginia. At the time, Macquarie had started a business in the US in about 2002, 2003, but that business was a bit up in the air at that point. Sorry,
that's okay.
So actually, to get to the US, I had to leave, you know, Macquarie. So I left Macquarie and joined Wells Fargo. Everyone knows, you know, who Wells Fargo are, a big US bank, and spent. Well, I think I spent about nearly 2 years there. But what was quite funny about that is the moment I landed, more or less really the moment I landed in the US, you know, I got a phone call from Mike Barrett, who you will remember well, and said, oh, look, you know, things have changed. We want you to come back. So I sort of felt a bit obligated to spend a bit of time at Wells Fargo before rejoining, you know, the Macquarie team, I think in sort of 2007.
And that's just as the GFC was ramping up, or
that's right. I mean, it was interesting for me spending 05 and 06 at Wells Fargo, and Wells Fargo were quite big in that. Oh, look, I used to call it predatory lending, but that's probably a bit mean. They were quite prevalent in that sort of subprime, you know, lending, both in terms of distributing their own product, but also buying a lot of those types of loan pools. Now, I must admit, it was very odd to me. I just thought, you know, coming from Australia in terms of the way that we operate and how we were underwriting loans in those days, I just thought, how is this sustainable? And then I remember when I went rejoin Macquarie and Doug Lee was in the US at that time looking after the sales teams, we found it really hard to retain good BDMs because these companies that were writing these sort of subprime and exotic loans, you know, were offering ridiculous incentives to BDMs to get them to come across and to build up their sales teams. So it was a very odd time, you know, just to be there and to watch it. And sure enough, you know, the history books tell us what happened there.
That's pretty funny because we touched on it earlier and I was, you know, flabbergasted where in Australia at that, you know, you could have gotten a loan just because you said you can afford it. So, and now you're telling us that, you know, the landscape in the US was even much more looser than that.
I think the biggest difference is I think we was, like, I feel we were still reasonably responsible around, when you think about assessment rates and how we assess loans in those days, you know, we still, you know, needed customers to service the loan based on an actual interest rate. And yes, I take your point that in some cases it was a self-employed borrower just signing a document to say they can make that repayment. It wasn't that straightforward, but the big difference in the US is they introduced these sort of low teaser rates that might have only been in existence for the first 6 months of the loan. And so, for example, it could be a 1% introductory rate for 6 months that then steps up to, I think the first home loan I took out in the US was about a 6.25% interest rate, and then it steps up to 6.25% after 6 months. But they assess the loan at 1%.
Oh wow.
So it was just things like that that when you sort of stand back and look at it, no surprise they ended up, you know, in the situation they did.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Because we're in the midst of a pandemic right now.
Yes.
The level of confidence, the availability of credit right now, is it similar to what happened?
No, I think it's very different, and I'll just use a couple of examples and share a couple of insights on that. I think the GFC, I mean, we were lucky in Australia that the GFC was not an economic crisis in this country. And what I mean by that is we didn't suffer a technical recession. And I think from memory, our worst quarterly economic contraction during the GFC was in late 2008. And I think from memory, it was only 0.5%. But then if you think about what happened with COVID, it was hard and it was fast. And we kind of went from 0 to 100%. In like weeks, and we suffered a huge economic recession where we had a contraction of I think it was 7% in June.
Yep.
So I think for me that's the biggest difference.
I think for me, and this is just the layman's view, right? So when the GFC first hit, I was, you know, I was with Citibank. The bank at the time had issues in the US, and, you know, and there was, you know, rumors inside the bank whether it would close up its Australian operations or not. So purely from a selfish point of view, I'd only just bought a house, I just bought a car, and I think, and we were trying to have a baby as well, and the amount of stress and the amount of you know, the unknown at the time, I felt it. I know that the wider Australia didn't.
You're absolutely right, and I think as did we at Macquarie, and we did for two reasons. What happened in the GFC was banks and that financial sector were, of course, you know, hit very hard. There was all sorts of funding, you know, challenges during that time. Some banks took on massive losses because of their exposure to some of those derivatives and other instruments that generated most of the losses. Mm-hmm. And I'm in your boat. Like we at Macquarie, we as you know, and many brokers will remember, we shut down the business in Australia for a while, and we actually shut down the US business as well. And I think from memory, a day in March 2008, we told all the US employees that had unfortunately made the difficult decision to close the business. And that was a very sad day, because I think we made 125, you know, people, 150 people redundant.
Wow. Okay.
So I think, yes, within our sector, it was very tough. There was a lot of stress. A lot of people lost jobs. Mm-hmm. But if we think more broadly, when you look at just an economic impact, the GFC was minor compared to where we're at with, you know, COVID. And I think the other thing which is interesting is during the GFC, credit growth plummeted here. I think credit growth pre-GFC was growing sort of 15% year on year or something like that. And it almost, you know, went to zero. Where during COVID, there's been little change. The last 6 months, really, from a credit growth perspective, has been no different to the prior 6 months. And what's been quite remarkable for me is, as I talk to my peers and I talk to aggregator heads, this has been the busiest period in terms of volume on record. You know, a number of aggregators have said to me, we've hit records, you know, during this period, which I think we're all astounded by, that credit growth and just activity has stood up as much as it has. And I don't know why. I really, you could sort of opine a bit that people are at home and people are trying to get finances in order and this and that. I don't know that it's any one thing, but I think it's quite remarkable that there's so much credit activity going on.
Yeah. And then I guess some part of it would be just like you said, more people are at home or more people are working outside the office. So then they have more time to, I suppose you could do their research online, yes, in terms of what other offerings there are and, you know, away from the traditional channels. But anyway, let's move on a little bit. So obviously I knew you as with when I was, you know, my brief period when I was at Macquarie, but then now you've moved away from Macquarie and you sort of lead the sales team at Bluestone. Mm-hmm. So have you found out so far, is there any similarities or do you see, as you were saying before, just these opportunities, because I guess there's more people aware of what Bluestone does, there's more people aware of what the alternatives are rather than the majors?
I think it's a bit of both. I think, you know, for me, joining, you know, Bluestone and I think taking carriage for sort of sales, marketing and product, what I saw was, well, what Bluestone is today reminded me a lot of what Macquarie was like, you know, back when I joined 2001. I think, and what I mean by that is that you had a market that was open to new lenders sort of really rising, you know, up and making a push in terms of, you know, market share aspirations and growth aspirations. Mm-hmm. I saw, you know, there's an opportunity today as there is back then, I think, to do things a little bit differently. And I'll talk about that in a minute. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing about Bluestone that reminds me a bit of Macquarie, you know, back in the early days, is just good people that want to do the right thing by brokers and their customers. Mm-hmm. and just get stuff done and not worry about sort of any of the distractions that you often see in, you know, in large organizations. Mm. So a lot of similarities. And I think, you know, to your point around the opportunities, I think, yes, today, for various reasons, I think a lot of brokers are a lot more familiar with the non-bank lenders and where they're different and their capabilities and how they can provide solutions. Mm-hmm. I still think we've got a long way to go with raising that same level of awareness with consumers, and I see that as a big opportunity. Mm-hmm. The second is we talk at Bluestone and we talk with our brokers about, we at Bluestone talk about customer stories, not credit scores. And I use that as a bit of a, you know, a euphemism for, you know, banks are starting, or I feel banks are starting to prioritize automation and efficiencies and cost cutting over customers. and we're actually going in the opposite, you know, direction. And where we actually really think the ability for brokers and customers to speak to people, to understand better the solutions we're providing, or if we can't provide a solution, why we can't provide a solution.
Mm. That's one of the biggest bugbears of a broker, which is sending a deal in and then having it decline, even when the credit report is so clean, but yet they send it into a lender.
I actually think it's really, you know, disrespectful, because brokers don't send a lender a deal to piss them off or for the deal to be declined. Mm. The broker sends them a deal because they legitimately believe that that's a deal that bank wants to do.
Mm.
And so for a bank just to send a cold decline message to the broker without any explanation, and then for a broker, if they want to call up that lender to understand why have you declined my loan, and have to wait 2 hours on the phone, I think that's just the utmost, you know, disrespect to that person.
Yeah.
And to me, that's not it's the furthest thing from the definition of a partnership.
Absolutely.
Sorry, you go.
So I was just going to say that I just found it absolutely weird that, you know, sometimes when you just, you know, when you can't get an approval, but then you don't get told why.
No, and look, so, and I know the, and look, I recognise, and I think we all appreciate that the environment we're in today is, you know, very different. And if you think away the way that, you know, APRA, you know, managing, you know, the banks, and there's a number of different things that the banks have got to now deal with in terms of prudential measures, risk weights, LVR caps, investment lending caps, interest only caps, exposure limits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it goes on, buffers, floors. I get why it's hard, but I don't think you can deal with it in the way that some banks have chosen to. And I think that, you know, some of the banks are taking a bit of a view on the market that there are so many customers out there that we can actually just pick and choose the ones that we want to look after.
Mm-hmm.
And we're taking, again, a very different view to that. And I think that's one of the strengths of being a non-bank lender, is that we can provide a solution to all sorts of customers, not just the very, very best ones,
mm-hmm.
but ones that are actually having some challenges in their life, whether it's income related, credit impairment, whatever it might be. You know, we have solutions for many, not just a few. And I talk about internally that some of the competition are sort of moving in this direction and zigging, and we'll move in the opposite direction and we'll zag. and I think if we can sort of continue to do what we do today, you know, well and at scale, look after our brokers, look after our customers, communicate well, provide solutions, access to our credit people, all that sort of stuff, I'm quite optimistic that there's a big opportunity for a lender like us, and that we can over time earn the right to do business with more brokers and grow our market share.
That's awesome. Now, for obviously the general audience, some of them won't know, but when you said that you can cater to all clients, this is also we're talking about the prime clients as well, right?
Yeah, so that's right. I think, you know, where we're unique is we've got a we need to define prime, because I think prime is a word that people just think it's about good credit, and I mm-hmm. think that's part of it. I think for me, and when we talk about prime internally, prime is both about, you know, good credit, but it's also about price and it's about experience. And so, yes, we have a prime offer, and what I mean by that is that we have a product and a solution at a price that the very best, you know, customers in, you know, in terms of, you know, credit and credit history would expect to receive.
Mm.
And our rates, for example, are as low as anyone's. So we're competitive from that perspective. I think we, through the process, provided a slightly different experience than others. But so, yes, we have that on one end of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And we have our specialist, you know, products at the other end of the spectrum, which, you know, which cater to people that may have had some challenges in the past, whether it be income, you know, related, you know, whether it be people that have just, you know, started a, you know, a new business and you know, don't have a standard 2 years, you know, with their ABN, or people that have, you know, credit impairments, whether it's, you know, defaults, their current arrears, the current mortgages in arrears, or things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So as I call it, we can cater for great customers where life's going well and they're on the happy path, as well as customers where things aren't as great as they'd like them to be, and they're coming in what I call the unhappy path.
Our
intent and our commitment is, regardless of which path you come in on, you always end up on the happy path with Bluestone.
Yeah. Well, I can kind of see what you're trying to do there as well, because you made, you know, Mac the kind of like the leaderboard there in terms of the sort of the FOS there as well. Mm-hmm. But the key thing I'm looking at right now is your turnaround times. So your rates and your products and your team are great. But your turnaround time is also pretty great, and that's not something that you kind of talk about often. And right now, more than ever, one of the biggest complaints on Finance and Coffee is the turnaround times from the majors. So it frustrates me, actually. I see these comments about, you know, lender A or lender B having, you know, a 30-day turnaround time, when, hey, a business like Bluestone can turn it around in a day and at least give you an answer, make you look good, right? So,
but again, I think it's simple, and maybe we just look at, you know, this situation too simplistically. I think, to me, to end up at a turnaround time of 30 days, 40 days, 20 days, I think it's quite irresponsible. And I think what sort of annoys me, and I know if it annoys me, it annoys many, many brokers, is lenders that come out with some type of promotion, whether it's a cash back, whether it's a promo rate, whatever it might be to grow volumes, but yet they can't deal with additional volume and they end up, you know, with long delays. And I actually think it's a poor insight into the way that business is managed, because if you can't forecast accurately what your business is going to do over the next 3, 6, 12 months, you know, that's problematic. It was a non-negotiable, you know, for me. I think, having done this at Macquarie and, you know, and numerous times both in Australia and overseas, growing businesses and understanding what it means to manage 200% year-on-year growth, that sort of stuff, I think we have a bit of a different view, a view of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it just, for me, it was, you know, one is a commitment from the entire organisation that turnaround times are really important. And if we want to achieve what we want to achieve, that is a non-negotiable.
Do you think like for those lenders, the problem would be silos? So as in, I'm saying that the sales team wants one thing, but then the operations team is handled by another team or another manager with a different, you know.
I think there's an element of that, and I think we've sort of ended up, and just from my experience at Macquarie, as it grows and it's a big bank now, is yes, I think the silos and the way that businesses have been decentralized doesn't help. But I think people are afraid to put their hand up and say, I want to spend some more money because I want to hire some more people. I think we're focusing on the wrong things. I think we focus on expenses far too much. And I think what happens when a sales team goes to an operations team and says, here are our forecast, these are the volumes that we think we're going to write over the next 6 months or whatever it might be, I think A, some of the ops teams treat that with a bit of, what's the word, not contempt, but with a bit of doubt. Oh yeah, okay, well we'll see it when it comes in. Okay, well, it's too late when that happens.
Absolutely.
And then I think when push comes to shove, I think so many operational teams, credit teams, support teams are measured by the expense management side of that business. And I think people are afraid to put their hand up these days in some of the big banks to say, we need to hire more people and we need to spend money. So I think it's a combination of things, and I think this is one of the great things about dealing with a smaller lender like Bluestone is you don't have those silos, you don't have, you know, a business that is heavily decentralized. You know, we all work, you know, closely together. The exec team, you know, which includes Tim Miller, who heads up all our operational teams, you know, we meet every morning at 8:30 without fail. And we're all on the same page. We're all looking at the same numbers and we're all moving in the same direction. I think it just makes that whole part of what we do and ensuring that we can always deliver the service that brokers expect so much easier.
That's awesome. Well, mate, thank you so much for your time. Now, on this, what we'd love to end is if the audience can just pencil it in anyway, or just have a mental note. What I'd love to have you come back on and do a series with regards to, you know, the emerging trends and the post-COVID lending landscape, because let's face it, we're looking at I'm stuck in Victoria right now. And today, you know, our figures was less than 20 new cases, right? Whereas a couple of months ago, we were above 200. So if things are going the way they are, we are looking at things potentially looking better rather than looking worse. So I'd love to have you come on board and you know, chat to see how things are going. And obviously, you know, what else is happening. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Well, James, thank you so much for your time today. And looking forward to catching up with you soon.
Thanks, Deanne. It's been a pleasure to be part of this, and I hope the audience, you know, learned something today, enjoyed it, and I look forward to doing it again soon.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much. Bye.